for that'll do it for me here on in this week. Have a great day. Hello, everyone. It's me, Mitch Saunders, once again, bringing you our weekly dose, or I guess at this point bi-weekly dose, because I've missed every other week the last 2 weeks, but weekly dose of electoral analysis from Swing Politics with Big Mitch. It is a not-so-bright and early, not-so-sunny 10:04 in Medford, Massachusetts. At WMFO Medford, Tufts Freeform Radio. And we've got a lot to talk about today. We've got a lot of good stuff on the agenda. And I'd like to start out with a fun little addition of what's broken in polling today. And I won't do this every week, but I like making little additions of things. Like last time that I was on, I spoke about the first time that the term two primary as a verb came up in the 2004 Pennsylvania Republican Senate primary. And today, I will be pointing out a poll that was just done by Harvard and Harris X, which is just the name of the polling company with the university that they sort of work with. Doesn't have anything to do with Kamala Harris. And that poll found that in a general election matchup, of Trump versus Biden, Trump's up 2 points. Now, this isn't a crazy polling result. Sort of makes sense with what everyone else is saying right now. Do I necessarily believe it? Not sure that I'm convinced. But regardless, it's a possible result. However, this poll also asked that if Trump is convicted of crimes, how will you vote? So same respondents who said Trump plus two. So out of the number, I believe it was like 800 of them, it was 51-49 Trump. That number jumps for Trump from 51 to 54 versus Biden's 46. So if there's any world in which a conviction makes 6% of people, or I guess 3% of people in total, change their mind and fully switch their votes, I don't know if we can really have a political governance system, to be fully honest. But the main point of this is that there's no world in which that is a real result. If Trump were convicted in even a single trial, his support can't go up. It's not possible. So I think that it's not a great pollster, from what I understand, but it is a really, really funny result to say when Trump's convicted, he gets more support. And some people might be like, oh yeah, well in 2016, he said all those things and he got more support than anyone thought he would. It's a different environment. Those were him just making statements to rile people up. These are criminal, you know, convictions or civil convictions, whatever they might become. But that's a really, really crazy result to just find from a poll in general. So does it lead me to believe that all the polls are broken? No. But I think there's some strange, funky stuff going on. There was just a Susquehanna poll, which is a pretty good firm, of the Pennsylvania general election. And that poll found some interesting stuff as well, sort of to a similar degree that this one was sort of wonky. It found that Biden was leading Trump by 5% in Pennsylvania. Now, that's not really a crazy result for 2020 polling standards when Biden was leading Wisconsin by 17 points a week before the general election. But 5%, leading by 5% in a swing state right now is huge news for the incumbent, because Biden is down in a lot of polls, especially a lot of swing state polls. And Susquehanna is a good pollster, and Biden was at 50 and Trump was at 45. And there's a you know, big deal when you get to 50, when you get to 50% in polling, when you're polling in a race that's sort of there's a lot of undecided, you'll tend to get somewhere around a baseline of 42, 43, and maybe there's another candidate that might be ahead, 45, 46. But getting to 50% means that your voters are secure in the fact that they do, in this, at least in this one poll, that the voters do in fact want you, and there's really no other room for an alternative, because those 5% aren't all entirely going to break for Trump. However, The looking at the nuance of this poll is interesting because it breaks down the result by region, and Pennsylvania has some very, very unique specific features of its geography, of its layout, that you have the Philly suburbs in the southeast. You have on the west side you've got Pittsburgh, and in the northwest you have Erie County, these traditionally ancestrally Democrat, white working class voters who are, in this poll at least, swinging their vote, voting 61% for Trump to 67% for Biden, which is just a crazy result that honestly makes me want to throw that poll in the trash, more or less. But it also shows Biden doing significantly worse in Philly. So maybe Biden's not winning it by 5%, the state. But he could be tied with Trump. He could be 1 or 2 points ahead, maybe a point behind. But the polling is a little bit wonky right now. I think we've all sort of come to expect that at this point. There was a lot of polling in 2022 that was very wonky. 2020 was obviously way off. 2016 was off on the state level, but not nationally. So there's a lot to be said for funky polling right now. And, you know, news organizations will run with a poll that they feel just sort of draws eyes. There was a Maryland Senate primary poll, or Senate general election poll, for which I spoke about 2 weeks ago, the Maryland general election. Republicans got a key recruit of Larry Hogan, who's the former governor of the state. And he's sort of known in the state as a moderate, even if on the policy levels he really isn't. He's running against Angela Alsobrooks, a county executive from Prince George's County, and a multimillionaire Representative David Trone from the westernmost district of Maryland. Trone is someone who is a, you know, lockstep Democratic voter, but he is trying to buy his way into the seat, whereas Angela Alsobrooks has worked for communities across, especially Prince George's County, but in important areas in Maryland, consistently, and is sort of, in my opinion, the better one that deserves this seat. And it also is a bit of a shakeup in the race recently when Representative Trone accidentally, as he apologized for, because he didn't know that he used a racial slur, which was something that obviously I won't be using on the air. But it's, you know, an interesting thing to go look up and look up the statement that he made, because I think it's important for people to learn these terminologies that we don't know that might have. You know, racist backgrounds, where he meant to say one word and he said another one, and that it's something that I think is a learning experience for everyone, because I hadn't heard of that word before. So I think that's something to really, really pay attention to in this race, that there is someone who's more in touch with Maryland, Marylanders and their politics, especially having such a significant African-American community in the state with Baltimore and the sort of suburbs and exurbs of Washington, D.C. So, you know, it's a race that Angela Alsobrooks deserves to certainly win. Because even if it is, you know, a mistake, language of that caliber, even if unknown by a sitting representative, is not something that should be tolerated. So especially in a state that has such a big African American community. So what the polls showed us, at least, was that Hogan was up 12% against Trone and 14% up against Alsobrooks, and he was sitting at about 50% in both polls. Now, this doesn't really tell us that polling is bad per se, but it does say that. But what it did is it spawned a lot of media coverage. It spawned a ton of media coverage saying, is the Maryland race competitive, and is Maryland purpling, and all of the garbage punditry that people like to run with just to get eyes and just to get dollar donations for this race on both the Democratic and the Republican side. And the reality of the situation is that Hogan won't win this race. It might be a little bit closer than if he was a generic Republican, but he certainly won't win this race, as I went into last episode of this sort of podcast, of this radio show, I should say, more so than podcast, that former governors that run in a state that's hostile to them, so a Republican governor in a strongly Democratic state, or a Democratic governor in a strongly Republican state, never really win. They overperform what the baseline partisanship of the state is, but they never ever win the race. So, yeah, polling's funky. Don't listen to it. 7 months out, if you want to do something and listen in, read some articles, make a donation here or there to the competitive Senate races. Nevada, Montana, Arizona, Michigan, Wisconsin, Yeah. Ohio. Those are the races that you should be donating to if you are going to donate, or just read up on some articles on Politico, New York Times. That's sort of a better way than to worry about the polls and watch the NBC anchors, flap their arms around for a couple hours just discussing stuff that isn't really relevant to the political sphere that's going on, to the reality of the political situation. But speaking of one of these Senate races that I was discussing, because I love talking about Senate races, the Ohio Senate race just had its Republican primary on Tuesday. And there were three candidates that were running for this race. There was Trump-endorsed businessman Bernie Moreno, moderate state senator Matt Dolan, endorsed by the Ohio governor Mike DeWine, and something in the middle, political ideology, Secretary of State Frank LaRose. The dynamics of the race were that LaRose, the Secretary of State, who had name recognition, was elected twice on the statewide ballot and was proven to be electorally strong, was in an early lead and then really, really crashed as this race went on. Moreno received Trump's endorsement and, you know, pulled ahead substantially as sort of that endorsement has weight with any population of Republicans, maybe except for Vermont Republicans. And Dolan was not doing so great initially behind LaRose, Frank LaRose. And then he pulled ahead of LaRose and then came in even at the end of the up to the election with Moreno. And people were really speculating, oh my gosh, is this going to be an upset for Trump? Is his grip finally going to be lost? And is Moreno going to be able to secure this seat for the Republicans? Because the common knowledge is that Dolan, who's a state senator, who's worked with Democrats to get bills passed in the state Senate, was endorsed by sort of their moderate, moderate in quotes, meaning relatively moderate. So he's extreme, but he is, policy-wise, he's extreme, but he's perceived as moderate by the electorate, that Dolan was going to be the one that was going to easily win this seat against Sherrod Brown, who is the incumbent Democratic senator who's won, he's running for his fourth term. And so people asked, is Dolan going to sort of secure this? And in the primary, it'll basically be over versus Bernie Moreno, who's endorsed by Trump and is way more extremist and doesn't have any experience in the political realm. Now, I'll get into the dynamics of the results of the race, but the logic behind why Bernie Moreno would be a weaker candidate is because of his extremist policies, which by statistical testing has indicated that extremist candidates with bad perceptions in the public eye in terms of how right wing they are, and especially like election denialists, which Bernie Moreno is one of, perform significantly worse by somewhere around 3 points compared to a generic, more moderate Republican. And that 3 points is a huge percentage. And it cost Republicans easy layup wins in 2022 in Arizona, in Georgia, in Pennsylvania. And it also proved to be an underperformance for the 2022 Senate candidate in Ohio, J.D. Vance, who also had no political experience or very, very little, and was critical of Trump in 2016. So that's where sort of there's a major difference. But I'm going to get back to the point and I'll get into the dynamics of comparing 2024 to 2022. Essentially, Dolan, because he was more moderate, could get those swing voters, the suburban voters that are needed sort of to win a lot of these elections, and would easily secure this race after the primary was done. However, Moreno ended up winning the primary, and not only did he win the primary election, he got over 50%. He won every single county by either a plurality or a majority of support. So it was about 50% to Dolan's 33%, to LaRose's 17%. So any question that Trump doesn't have a grip on the party anymore, he's weakening it, is questionable at best. This is his party. Republicans just the other Republicans just have to sort of dance around in it. And what does this mean exactly for the Senate overall and for this specific Senate race? So for Democrats to keep the majority, as I've said basically on every single show, they need to win two seats. They need to win Ohio and they need to win Montana. Ohio is a Trump plus eight state that has a partisanship of, you know, Republican plus 13 at baseline in a neutral environment. The state will, in a you know, nationally neutral environment, the state will vote 13 points to the right of the nation, of how the overall nation votes, basically the national popular vote. And because of this, it means that Marino and Brown, the matchup, Brown has a really heavy lift, regardless of who he was going against, actually. Brown had a very heavy lift. And he needs every ounce of support he can get. And Dolan would have a lot of suburban, sort of maybe independents, Republicans, Democrats, who are not so sure who they want to vote for. They maybe don't love the Democratic Party, but they're not a fan of extremists. And Sherrod Brown is a notable bipartisan. He is someone that has come up strong for unions and workers and fair pay. And they know him. They know him because they voted for him since 2006. And so Sherrod Brown has high name recognition. And he's got a war chest because he's obviously had money that he's raised from cycles in the past. He's sitting on $14 million on cash, out the gate, versus Bernie Marino, who is an independent businessman who's a millionaire, he has money, but he just spent a ton of it trying to get through a scorching primary. So because Brown is going up against Marino, and Marino's more extreme, he's in a better position. Essentially, the pundits would have rated this race as lean Republican if Dolan received the nomination, but instead, they're leading it as toss-up because Marino got the nomination. And that's why this is electorally the most important thing of the past 2 weeks. Because if Democrats keep this race, they are in a really much stronger position to keep the Senate. I won't say it's likely or guaranteed, but it's a stronger position if they can hold on to this Ohio seat. And Ohio has been racing away from Democrats since really 2012. And so some people might point to the fact that, Ohio is too far gone for Democrats, that in 2024 there was a similar situation where you had Trump pulling for a candidate, J.D. Vance, who is now the sitting senator, and J.D. Vance was someone who had criticized Trump in 2016. He was, a very populist, conservative, extremist guy, and that, you know, he was running in a crowded primary, and that Vance just didn't understand the working class people of Ohio. He didn't understand Ohioans, and it didn't really matter ultimately, sort of the lean of the district, because the lean of the state, because Vance didn't appeal to voters. Vance ended up winning the state by 6%, which is an underperformance in a Republican leaning year. And it was against Tim Ryan. Sorry, Tim Ryan was a representative, a Democratic representative in the state for around a decade. And the difference between Vance and Marino in this case, at least in the dynamics of the race, is that that seat was obviously in a Republican midterm. So you're going to have differential Republican turnout. Even if Democrats and Tim Ryan were really good at persuasion, you're still going to have a differential Republican turnout which is going to inherently favor Vance. But the other point is that Vance criticized Trump in 2016, which I keep bringing up, but it sort of indicates the somewhat moderate nature of his candidacy, that he wasn't the moderate, but he could kind of appeal to who he needed to appeal to. This, you know, he was appealing to the mainstay conservatives and the Trumpists, but there was some portion of suburban voters who felt that they were okay voting with him. Bernie Moreno's a little bit of a different story. He's just more Trumpy. J.D. Vance, I don't believe, was an election denier or wasn't as overt with it. Bernie Moreno is very much overt with it. He just went on, I think it was like Newsmax or something, or Fox News, and said, you know, we don't want any moderate Republicans in our base. We just want, you know, true, pure Trumpers. We don't want any rhinos. And it's with rhetoric like that that Sherrod Brown will be able to sort of cobble up a coalition of, you know, working class voters, suburban voters, urban voters that will say, you know, you don't want us to vote for you. Fine, we'll vote for the other guy who's more moderate and can work across the aisle. There's another factor here in that Brown is the incumbent. In the 2022 race, Vance was not the incumbent, obviously, but neither was Ryan. The incumbent was Senator Rob Portman, who retired. So Brown has the incumbency bonus that Ryan never had. This race is definitely a toss-up. If I were to say who would win, I would be remiss to say that I think Bernie Moreno will win this race. Unless the environment shifts in a drastic way. Ohio is very, very hostile to Democrats right now. I listened to the 2006 election returns on YouTube. Someone had posted them. And they were the Ohio Senate race. This was when Sherrod Brown first won his term to the Senate race. And he actually was running against Senator Mike DeWine, who's the governor right now of Ohio. And Brown kicked out DeWine. And one of the anchors on NBC News said, you know Ohio, and Ohio's not friendly territory to Republicans. To be a Republican in Ohio is to be endangered. And isn't that crazy that, 18 years later? 18 years later, the situation is exactly flipped for Democrats. So things really do change in 15, 18, 20 years, even 10 years, things change. So the political dynamics are constantly shifting for many of these states. But in Ohio, it's going to be a very, very hard race for Sherrod Brown to win, not because he isn't liked, but because it's going to be a presidential year. You're going to have Trump at the top of the ticket. You're going to have non-college educated white rural voters coming out to support Trump, and therefore going to support Moreno as well. And the state is not stopping its rightward shift. It's continuing with each day, essentially. So it's going to be tough, but it's not an impossible race for Brown to win. He definitely got handed a gift with this nomination. And in other Senate news, that's good for Democrats. The New Jersey Senate Democratic primary ended yesterday, I believe. Maybe 2 days ago, I don't quite recall at this point. The race, to remind, was between Andy Kim, representative of a central New Jersey district. He won in 2018, flipped the seat, held it in 2020, held it in 2022, and decided to run to primary Bob Menendez after all of his gold bar, Egypt, basically corruption fiasco scandal that should never be allowed in the Democratic Party and should have never been allowed in the first place. And Kim decided to step up and essentially sort of take on the machine. There's very few party machines in states across the country, but New Jersey has one of them. And this race dynamic, Menendez said he would not run for the Democratic primary. But the governor's, the first lady of New Jersey, the governor's wife, Tammy Murphy, decided to also run in this primary. And the sort of way that the New Jersey primary system works is that there's something called the county line. And the county line decides which of the Democratic nominees are going to be placed at the top or the leftmost part the most prominent part of the ballot compared to other Democrats in that primary. So essentially, you would have in the primary the presidential at the top, then you would have the Senate and the House below it, and the people who receive the county line endorsement from the that county's Democratic Party receive the space right under the presidential ticket. So it goes President Joe Biden and the other names, and then just below that is going to be the person who receives the endorsement, and the other person will be listed, but they won't be listed in as much of a prominent way. And this was this election between Andy Kim, who's sort of a political outsider, versus Tammy Murphy, who is very much a political insider, really was a fight for and against the county line. Murphy, because of her husband's deep support, because he was elected in 2017, because of his deep support statewide, more so deep roots and connections, not necessarily support, because Democrats don't love Phil Murphy, the governor, but it's more that he has a lot of institutional support. Tammy Murphy was able to get a lot of backroom deals and support at conventions to give her the part, to give her the county line in, you know, a number of these counties. Andy Kim won a number of them as well, and the, and he won some that were unexpected for him to win. But at the same time, he had to play the game of the county line, but he also brought a suit against it, which the New Jersey Attorney General said he would not support. He would not support the case against, essentially. So the New Jersey governor sided, or the New Jersey Attorney General sided with Andy Kim, in the sense that the county line was something that was unconstitutional or unacceptable, limits voting rights, something of that nature. And while the court case itself is still working through the system, Tammy Murphy 2 days ago dropped out of this race. Now, her campaign was really floundering. She started out with overwhelming support based on polling, based on what the conventions to give the county line were showing. And Andy Kim stayed in the race and continued to sort of campaign. Murphy had a couple of flubs. It was uncovered that she voted Republican as recently as 2012. She was just someone that she's a big Wall Street girl. She was not someone that was hearing what the people of New Jersey wanted. And they wanted someone that really cares and really was putting in the time. And I think that the party leaders in these counties also saw that. And that's why the Murphy campaign just sort of tanked from day one. It was a very poorly run campaign on the social media scale. On the ground game, the only thing that it really had going for it was the name recognition and the county line. But I sort of appreciate the fact that Murphy decided to drop out instead of more mudslinging and spending and just sort of the volatility of the campaign. She decided to take the step back and understand that she wasn't exactly what New Jerseyans were searching for. That's not what they wanted, and she decided to drop out and hand the nomination to Andy Kim. Andy Kim is one of my favorite politicians, not in terms of his policy, but in terms of his humanity. He's someone that's a truly decent, kind, good person. And you can tell that just, you know, by his Twitter feed, that he's constantly making, not strange, but non-politician type posts about his kids and about, of course, you know, policies that he's supporting and the like. But that there's a great image, there's a picture of him on, I think it's January 6th, 2021, maybe January 7th or something. And he's in the Capitol Rotunda. And he is on his hands and knees with a dustpan and a broom, sweeping up broken glass from the insurrectionists that marched through the Capitol just days before. And he was just alongside the janitorial staff and the workers. And if that doesn't tell you about someone's character, nothing can. So he is a truly good, decent man who has proven in this primary cycle and in his representation of Central Jersey in the past and in the future, all of New Jersey, that he is someone who cares and someone who doesn't feel that it should be put on others to sort of clean up messes, either metaphorically or literally. And in doing so, because of Tammy Murphy's poor campaign, he's able to take down a lot of the party machine. A lot of the backroom deals that gave people nominations in the past. And this lawsuit is still well underway. The county line, we don't know what the ruling is going to be on it, and it might still be in place in the future. But it's much, much less. It's been gutted, the impact of the county line in primaries in New Jersey, which is a very, you know, niche thing to say, why this is so important. But it delivers better representation, and that's a win for the American people, and especially the Democratic caucus, and for New Jersey most of all. And so Kim, it will be the first ever Korean American senator, because it's not a competitive general election. New Jersey is a strongly Democratic state. So Kim won't face any headwinds in the general election, but he did what he had to do, and the better guy prevailed. I appreciate the fact that Tammy Murphy didn't continue the mudslinging contest, and sort of stepped away gracefully after a few months of a unfortunate campaign, but Kim was the right person for this seat. You don't want someone to buy or manipulate their way into the seat. You want it to be by the people. And I do believe that Kim would have won the primary even if it did get to June, because the primary is, I think, June 5th. Even if it did get to June and the election was held, I still think Kim would have won the primary, just based on the momentum. But the fact that there's not even a chance indicates the weakness with which Tammy Murphy felt her campaign was, and the groundswell of support from the local level that Kim was seeing. It almost feels somewhat similar to what I understand Obama's 2004 Senate campaign was like. So who knows? Maybe first Korean American senator, maybe first Korean American president in the future. Who knows? He's it's great. It's really, really good result. And with that, it seems like there's a lot of the races for the Senate are all but settled. I don't think that I announced last time that Kyrsten Sinema decided to bow out of the Senate race to run as an independent. We sort of knew this was coming because she wasn't collecting signatures to qualify for the ballot, but she's out. And in my mind, it basically guarantees a Democratic flip from Sinema, though she was an independent caucusing with the Democrats. The Democrat Ruben Gallego, who's a congressional representative, is a well-known name in the state, and the reason why he'll especially win is because he's facing Carrie Lake, the same Carrie Lake that was the election denier who lost the layup election for Arizona governor in 2022 against Katie Hobbs. So yeah, that's a good result that Sinema is sitting out, but I still think Gallego would have won regardless of whether or not Sinema was there. It's very hard to be a Joe Lieberman these days. Joe Lieberman was the was a Democratic senator from Connecticut who was primaried from his left and then decided to run third party Connecticut for Lieberman and won in 2006 in Connecticut as a senator and would stay there until I believe he only had one more term. So 2006 to 2012. And you can't do that these days. There's not enough crossover support in that sense. So even if Sinema was still there, she wouldn't have gotten over maybe 15% of the vote. In Wisconsin, Tammy Baldwin, the incumbent senator, is going to be running against businessman Eric Hoved. Bob Casey in Pennsylvania versus Dave McCormick. A lot of the races are very much settled. And Democrats have won in a lot of them. There's two races that are, in terms of, you know, the primary, who they're hoping to go against in terms of if they've won them. And there's two that are still left to be determined, Michigan and Nevada, both of which seem like no matter who will be nominated, Democrats are going to keep the seat, one, and two, that the Republican will be either unpopular or extremist. I don't talk about the House a whole lot, but there's been some news in the House with a bunch of retirements, unexpected retirements, and not only retirements, but resignations that have left Speaker Johnson's majority dwindle down to what will be one vote in a couple weeks. The two most recent, Ken Buck from Colorado's 4th Congressional District and Mike Gallagher from Wisconsin's 8th Congressional District. These are two names that are especially notable, and they both decided they are resigning. Buck just resigned. He resigned a few... He announced his resignation 2 weeks ago, his retirement, and then he just left the House today. And Gallagher said he would in, I think, 2 weeks or something of that nature. The reason why these two are... It's so interesting that these two have left their Republican caucus is because... Ken Buck was a Tea Party Republican. He came in 2010, was a super right-wing guy. So right-wing, sort of like the Marjorie Taylor Greene almost of today, but scaled back to 2010 version when things were still a little bit more tame. And, you know, Buck was anti Obamacare and anti, you know, basically everything good. And at this point, he has become a thorn in the Republican side because he didn't support the impeachment of Mayorkas. He doesn't support Biden's impeachment. He is someone that is now friendlier. He supports the discharge petition, I believe, for foreign aid to Ukraine, Gaza, Israel. He's someone that became a ideological left-wing member of a right-wing party because the party has gone so far right, which is insane to think that. Again, politics changes a lot over a decade and a half. Ken Buck was in the far right of his party, and he was part of the House Freedom Caucus in 2010, and he left the Freedom Caucus in 2023 because mostly he was pushed out. And in this Congress, he has been notoriously a thorn in the side of extremist Republican policies from the left end of their ideological spectrum. And that's just over 14 years, 15 years. Mike Gallagher is the other retiring Republican that is interesting because he was thrown around as a name to run against Tammy Baldwin in the Senate race this year. Gallagher is a very appealing guy. He had strong election performances. He has a very Republican district, but they like him there. He consistently sort of overperforms the partisan lean of the district. And he was, you know, a rising star of the Republican Party at one point. I don't believe he was a Tea Party member. Let's see if he was. No, he's not. He's not. He wasn't a Tea Party guy. He was elected in 2016. But he's out, too. And it's not that he's been necessarily a thorn in the side of Republicans in terms of his support. But it comes as a shock, as someone who was sort of hailed as we like this guy, we get along well with him, we like the stuff that he does, the people that he supports, and the like. Gallagher's ready to run for the door. So what does that say about the rest of the Republican caucus? I mean, the American people have seen firsthand how Republicans have no way that they don't know how to govern. The last time that Republicans had a House majority was in 2018. The Speaker was Paul Ryan, who was, again, a Tea Party guy, but relatively moderate compared to today's standards. And this was before, I guess, intense, crazy polarization with the election denialism and the, you know, unfounded impeachment stuff that the Republicans have been pursuing in this Congress. And they've got a 5-seat majority, and they can't govern. Even if they had a 10-seat majority, they can't govern. And so people don't want to stick around. The Republicans look bad. House Republicans look really, really bad. I don't know if the American people are necessarily paying attention to this in terms of, you know, the day in, day out of how the Republicans govern. But Johnson has required a majority of Democrats to pass his bills every time because he gets maybe half or less than half of Republican support on bills that he has to pass, like the recent government funding. He didn't get, I think, about half of Republicans of his own caucus to vote on it, and he needed Democrats to save him. 184 Democrats, or something of that nature, because 22 of them voted against it. Only 22 Democrats voted against the recent funding. Because Johnson didn't want a shutdown on his hands. But the caucus is so extreme and can't be controlled that they can't govern. There's a reason why this Congress has passed 22 or some very low number of bills. In recent history, it's been like upwards of 100. They can't pass anything. Even if it was divided Congress, they still passed bills. But they can't pass anything, even things that are ideologically strong for them. Or they love the policy of, they don't even have the numbers to pass it. And this is the problem, is when you have these Trump crazies like Matt Gaetz and I'm trying to think of a few others, and Marjorie Taylor Greene and Lauren Boebert. When you have these people and you openly endorse the idea of them being a part of your party only to burn things, like Greene calling to vacate Johnson, to vacate the speakership, what, a couple months before the election? I mean, you can't operate a party under those circumstances. So it's really unfortunate that Democrats will take back the House and lose the Senate, most likely. The median outcome is that Republicans will win back the Senate and Democrats will take the House, and Biden will win the presidency, at least in my mind. And that really sucks, because then you still don't get the legislation that you need to. And so Republicans can prove that they can't govern in the Senate either, because McConnell said he's stepping away from the leadership in 2024. So the next Congress will not have McConnell as leader. I don't know entirely who it will be. McConnell's somehow now a darling of the left, because, again, the party has gone so far right that now Democrats like McConnell, because he's supporting foreign aid. He's supporting the foreign aid bill in a very, very staunch manner. So Republicans cannot govern. They couldn't govern when they had full control of government. Why would they be able to govern when they have one chamber? Because from 2017 to 2018, the 115th Congress, Republicans had full control of government. And they couldn't pass anything. They only passed the tax cuts from Trump. Which, by the way, interestingly, those tax cuts are going to expire. I didn't know this at the time. I didn't actually learn this until a few weeks ago. But apparently the Trump tax cuts that gave breaks to corporations, big businesses, wealthy individuals, sunset in 2025, I believe, at the beginning of 2025, when the new Congress takes hold. So it's very unlikely that those tax cuts will come back into effect, which is great. So that's a little good news of policy. which is not exactly my forte. But, yeah, Republicans simply cannot govern. But just because all these Republicans are leaving, and there's been, you know, news spreading about that more Republicans will leave, doesn't mean that Democrats will suddenly take back the House. Republicans are not going to lose enough seats for Democrats to have some sort of, what, like, 213-member majority, something like that. They have there's a Democratic seat that's going to get filled, there's a Republican seat that's going to get filled, and Republicans won't leave. They won't leave the caucus for Democrats to end up having control of it. So there's a lot of sort of ideas about that flying around where, oh, you know, enough Republicans leave and Democrats gain the majority. Like, yes, it's possible, but Republicans realistically aren't going to do that. Again, as I said on the last show, don't count on Republicans to come and save Democrats. Republicans won't do good things for Democrats, but they'll do bad things for themselves, which is a very, very funky way of operating. And what else I'll say is that there's recently been some key questions that sort of I've been wondering about how the presidential race is going to shake out. There's a lot of nuance going on, especially with statements that Trump is making on the Israel-Gaza situation or the various legal battles that he's in, or how Biden is going to perform, given, you know, his lack of strength, I guess, in a performance capacity on the debate stage. And so the real questions that are sort of shaking out for me at this stage are, the big one is the money issue, not for the Biden campaign, but for the Trump campaign, because the Trump's got about a third on hand of what the Biden campaign has, and the RNC is the same way. And the RNC just said they voted to cover Trump's legal expenses. So it makes a very interesting situation of two things. Either Trump is he's not going to have the money for the race. He's going to be caught in legal battles. Republicans aren't going to be able to advertise, or he's going to get money from somewhere. He's going to get money from a wealthy benefactor in some way. I don't quite entirely understand financial, FEC laws, which provide specifics for financial disclosures and donations. But as of right now, he's going to get blown out in every single media market that's competitive. So that's one of the major questions for me, at least right now, is how is this Trump financial debt, I would say, relative to the Biden campaign, going to play out? Is it going to maintain, or is it going to be another thing that Donald Trump is able to wriggle his way out of? Which brings us to, you know, the Trump trials, where the New York trial was just set for April 15th. It's very, very unlikely that the D.C. trial will come to fruition because of the Supreme Court, which is something that I can get into another time, but they're just partisan hacks. The Florida case won't happen because the judge is Trump appointed, and the RICO case is unclear right now because of the legal battles that are surrounding Fannie Willis. We don't know how those are going to necessarily be decided, but the New York trial is something that will probably be ultimately ruled on before the election, at least Democrats can hope. The Israel-Gaza situation, don't know how that war is going to continue. Bibi Netanyahu said that he's going to invade Rafah, which is a red line that the Biden administration has said they will have to condition aid if they do so. We don't know what this situation is going to look like, and that's a huge question. How are voters going to react to Trump being back in the limelight? We're starting to see some polling shifts towards Biden. It's been very, very Biden unfriendly and hostile recently in the polling. And recently we've seen very, very small movement in terms of his approval rating and in terms of his head-to-head matchups with his strength of how he's going to perform in the coming months.
So that also leads us to not only performance for Trump, because, you know, Trump being back in the limelight, voters will realize he's actually crazy and possibly will pull their support for him. We don't know, because 2020 polling told us very different things. But also, how's Biden going to perform at the debates? And as I mentioned about on the last show, will Haley endorse Trump? The point is that we don't know so many things, and it's so early, and to put all the emphasis on polling is not important right now. To put all the emphasis on sort of how the election will shake out right now is not important, but there are key factors that I provide in this radio show that are historically based and provide tilts one way or the other, but they don't decide anything uniformly, and that's a very important nuance here. The only things that we do know that will be in favor of Biden, we got 3 Fed rate cuts that are coming up. Maybe one will be, you know, sort of too late, so maybe 2 that might take hold in terms of economic importance come election time, and also that he's an incumbent. And those are 2 things that we know are good for Biden, no matter what happens. All right. Well, this has been a great show. I really hope that you all have enjoyed Swing Politics this week with Big Mitch. Mitch Saunders. You're listening to 91.5 FM, WMFO Medford, Tufts Freeform Radio. I hope that I will be back next week, because every time I say I'm not back next week, and then I'm back every other week. So we'll see. But thanks for listening, and everyone, enjoy the rest of your Tuesday.
WMFO in Medford. Wow, what is that?